Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Sian Kane.
What do you lose when you lose your memories? The upturned box of photographs is scattered across the ivory-laced duvet. I pick one from the pile and turn it over in my hands. Sarah and Gemma, aged around 6 and 3. Chubby legs neatly fitted into toweling shorts on a sandy beach. I smile as the moment comes back to me. Our first holiday, just the three of us. Then something else washes over me. A sadness that has been growing inside me for weeks. Am I really going to forget all this? Will I, one day soon, clutch this photograph in my hands and not know the two happy faces that smiled back? It doesn't seem possible. I feel an urgency, staring hard at the photograph, determined to outwit my fading brain. I won't forget.
What makes us who we are? If someone asked you to define who you are, a lot of us might say our memories are key to what makes you, you. But what happens when you lose those memories? That voice you heard before is Wendy Mitchell, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 58. She is the author of a new memoir, Somebody I Used to Know, in which she documents the progression of her dementia and the effect it has had on those around her. We'll hear more from Wendy later, but right now with me in the studio is Dr. Jules Montague, a neurologist who also has a book out about the brain and how it relates to your sense of self. Jules, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And your book, Lost and Found, it explores a whole range of changes to the brain, whether it's different kinds of dementia to deliberately induced changes like psychedelic drugs and how that relates to our sense of self. But Wendy has young onset Alzheimer's. Can you just explain what that means and what is happening to Wendy's brain?
Sure. So Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. The terms often get a bit mixed up, but dementia is the umbrella term. And what it means is neurodegeneration of the brain. So that means the synapses, the networks, the connections get affected in some way. And lots of things can be disrupted as a result, memory being the most common type. But we also get language, behaviour, other types of thinking. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia, as I said, and that's the one where primarily memory is affected most. And in her case, in Wendy's case, of course, Alzheimer's in herself came younger than in other people.
Yeah, so there's two terms that I've heard, and there's early onset, and in your book you use young onset. But they're the same, right? And they're talking about pre-65.
Yeah, so most people we see with Alzheimer's develop the condition around the age of 65 and then it becomes more common after that. However, even in my clinics, for example, I see people a lot younger than that. There are other types of dementia which manifest younger again. So people with a type of dementia called FTD or frontotemporal dementia, which affects your personality more so than your memory, that tends to manifest in the 50s or so. There are certainly lots of similarities between people who develop dementia younger and older when it comes to Alzheimer's, but there could be some differences in terms of the genetics and the pathology and so on. So they might not be exactly the same.
And you mentioned the genetics. What is the role of genetics in Alzheimer's?
Probably the most important thing I would say to my patients generally is to try and reassure people. So if, for example, you had a grandmother who had Alzheimer's and you think that's inevitable, that's certainly not the case. Genes play a role, but probably the most important contributor is age. So it's more likely as time goes on. In the young onset forms, things are different. So we know that genes seem to be more important in those forms. And research into those genes might we're not quite sure, but might give us some answers for the future for other people also with Alzheimer's.
And in terms of the recent research that's being done with Alzheimer's, there have been some conversations that have been happening around whether Alzheimer's is a form of memory loss or whether it is actually something that's impacting our ability to call upon those memories. So the memories are still actually there, it's just we can't get to them. Is that giving people a sense of hope, do you think?
Yeah.
Those memories are still there?
For sure, it gives me a lot of optimism, particularly when research has been really, I suppose, disappointing thus far. We don't have any drugs that reverse dementia right now. And, you know, I would hope that perhaps that's just because it's not a matter of stimulating memory to work in quite the way we thought before. It could be that the memories are right in there in the recesses of the mind. We need to delve deep and bring them back out. So there is room for optimism there, and there's some new research techniques that suggest that perhaps that could be a possibility.
In your work as a neurologist, the brain is such a complex thing, but do you get the sense that we're only really scraping the surface? We don't necessarily completely understand what is going on in our brains?
That's a good question. I suppose with Alzheimer's, there's a lot that is understood, but I'm not sure if we understand the right stuff. So, for example, we know the proteins that we find in the brains of people who have Alzheimer's, the ones that are misfolded and not quite right. So amyloid and tau are those proteins. And a lot of the research targets those proteins, but it hasn't been successful in terms of the drugs we have right now. So it's quite possible that those proteins are things that happen downstream. They're way down the line. So when we are designing drugs and so on, we need to go upstream. We need to find out what happens 20 years before, because we know with Alzheimer's, the process, if it happens in your brain, could happen about 20 years before you first lose that important memory.
And in your book, you have a patient called Anita that you refer to and you talk about her diagnosis. And when she first comes in, she says that she noticed the symptoms first, which were primarily things like losing her keys or taking the wrong turn off when she was driving to work. Is that sort of typically how it manifests in the early stages?
Yeah, so one thing that's quite singular about Alzheimer's is that people usually realise there's something not quite right. And they're the patients that come into clinic and will tell me, I think there's something that's just different right now. And as time goes on, they might lose that insight, but it is quite unique. We don't see that in other types of dementia, FTD, the one that I mentioned before, frontotemporal dementia. Patients lose insight right from the outset, so they don't really realise something is going on. What I would say is, since I've written this book, lots of people have come to me and said, you know, I've lost my keys, I can't find my car sometimes in the car park, do I have dementia? And again, I'm keen to reassure there's a difference between losing your keys, which is something we all do, or at least I do on a daily basis, and not knowing what your keys are for. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. It's similarly, I think, quite usual to lose your car in the car park every now and then. But the thing that would be unusual and would, you know, merit taking a closer look is if you forget what car park you parked your car in and you go to the other side of the city. So there are the differences.
We'll hear from Wendy in a bit, but in her interview with Claire when she came in, she says that she no longer feels anger anymore. And you talk about different kinds of dementia in your book. There's particularly frontotemporal dementia, which relates to things aside from memory, so things like empathy and personality. Can you explain how all these different forms of dementia are related to each other?
Sure. So frontotemporal dementia tends to get a bit neglected, actually, when we talk about dementia, because Alzheimer's is more common. So you could see why that might happen. But actually, it's a very important type of dementia, particularly in younger people. The average age is around the 50s. And because the front of the brain is affected more so than anything else, it's behaviour and personality that tend to get affected. And personality can change in lots of different ways. So in the book, I discuss a character called Martin, and he becomes disinhibited. So he no longer is able to control his impulses. So he takes off his clothes in the street and he swears and so on. Some patients with FTD or frontotemporal dementia become apathetic, so they lose all their motivation. What's important, there's a few things that differentiate from Alzheimer's in terms of the identity question. And one of them is the lack of insight. So as I said, people with FTD don't really realise that there's something going on, and that's pretty early on. The other thing is we tend to see a personality change as even more threatening to identity than a memory change. And we particularly think that any changes in moral traits, moral characters, and studies have shown this, we really think that means that person has completely changed. So, for example, if you were to have a change in your compassion or your honesty or empathy, your family and friends would probably say she's a different person now. But if you were to have differences in other personality traits, nothing to do with morals, so curiosity or creativity, they'd say you're a bit different, but they wouldn't say you're a different person. And that's why FTD is sometimes, not always, but sometimes seen as more of a threat to identity, more so than and Alzheimer's, I think. And that's why I've sort of chosen those two characters, Martin, who has FTD, and Anita, who has Alzheimer's, to show how identity can be influenced by what we experience.
And in the book, you do explore a really interesting conundrum, which is that when dementia brings on some sort of positive change, that can be read as, oh, well, now they're the person they truly were, you know, that whatever was inhibiting their kindness or whatever it is that's somehow improved. People read that as, oh, well, this is the person that they've always been. Whereas when dementia brings on some sort of negative change, people begin to worry that that person is now no longer the person that they were.
Exactly. So the direction of change is really important. And even when I started writing this book, it was based not quite on dementia, but a friend whose mother had a brain tumour, and this mother appeared to have become a nicer person. So it was very tempting for me to say, oh, it's nothing to do with the brain tumour, it's all to do with how she is now. And the same challenge comes along in dementia, obviously. One of the difficulties of taking that approach is that you could say, so for example, Martin, who has FTD, becomes very aggressive and violent. He walks down the street and he gesticulates at people. And does that mean now we should say that Martin, who was lovely before, that he had this terrible man that was lurking under, you know, under the surface for all of these years? That seems quite unfair to say. So it's really about disentangling all the who they were before and who they are now. And of course, who are they going to be in the future?
And another thing that unites Wendy's book with yours is this connection of what's going on in someone's brain and how that connects to their sense of self. Are they the same person before their diagnosis as they are after their diagnosis? And you talk about Anita, who does progressively get worse and worse and begins to lose a lot of her memory. And you look a little into the connection between memory and self and whether that is actually a very intrinsic factor in what makes us us. What conclusions did you come to in the end?
I think we're more than our memories, so they're certainly very important. So if I asked you to think of your three best or worst memories right now, and then I said, I'm going to extract them from your brain and you no longer have them, you would certainly be quite disconcerted. You'd feel in some ways a different person, but it wouldn't necessarily take away the essence, as we used to call it, of who you are. And likewise, I think it's unfair to put such importance on memory, because it suggests that if you do develop Alzheimer's, even in the mild or the moderate stages, that losing your memory means you lose your identity. And I don't think that's the case. And as Wendy Mitchell's book demonstrates, she still has intelligence and autonomy and agency, all of those things, and judgment. And so to say that she is not herself any longer, you know, just seems unfair. She's the best judge of really to tell us, you know, when she feels herself or not. And there's times in the book where she does feel her identity is threatened. But simply to say that just because you have Alzheimer's, just because you've lost your memory, means you're a different self, I think is undermining people with dementia.
Dr. Jules Montague. Recently, Wendy Mitchell and her ghostwriter Anna Wharton came to the studio to meet with Claire and talk about Wendy's memoir on having dementia.
Somebody I used to know. That is an amazing title for a book.
Yeah. I just wanted people to see my former self and how I used to be, all the things I used to do, as a sort of history as to all the changes that have happened since being diagnosed.
And so you have what's called young onset,
yes,
Alzheimer's. Yes. And how did you discover it?
Well, I didn't really discover it. I just knew something was wrong, wasn't right. Alzheimer's never even entered my head as to that may be a possibility, because I was only 58 at the time. But I think the time that is clear in my head is the time I came out of my office and just didn't know where I was or who all the people around were or the voices I could hear. And it was at that point that I realised this obviously isn't right. There's something wrong. I need to find out what's happening to me.
And you're absolutely the sort of person who we always imagine wouldn't get something like this, because you were incredibly fit, you ran lots, you did all sorts of things that people say, oh, this will keep Alzheimer's at bay.
Yes, I didn't fit the profile whatsoever. But I think that just goes to show that dementia doesn't discriminate against lots of the way people live. You know, it's just I was just an unlucky one.
The thing about this book is it is a real piece of literature. I started reading it and I was not expecting what a gripping read it is. And that's partly to do, obviously, with you, Wendy, because your blog, I'm now addicted to your blog, which is the source material for it. But it's also partly to do with you, Anna. Tell us about this relationship. You've ghosted it. You approached Wendy, I gather, in the first instance.
Yeah, so I saw a Facebook video, just one of these videos that's shared on Facebook of Wendy talking about what it's like to live with dementia. And at first I kind of skipped past it because my father had vascular dementia before he died, and I thought, oh, I don't want to know about that, that's depressing. And as a writer, you kind of veer towards the subjects that scare you, or I do. And so I watched it and I was really, really moved by it. Not just moved, but it made Alzheimer's and dementia seem less frightening to me. And I shared it on my page and people thanked me for sharing it. And then I thought, if it's made me feel like this, then it could make other people feel like this. And I think as a ghost, I like to take on roles that I haven't done before. You know, I haven't written before.
What other sort of books have you done?
So I've done a book about FGM called Cut, and I've done a book about Jo Milne, who was a deafblind woman, and a domestic violence memoir as well. So I contacted Wendy, and it's nice and very complimentary what you say about the book, because, you know, when deciding how to construct it, I wanted it to be a book that could be enjoyed by lots of people who just wanted to spend some time in Wendy's world, not necessarily people who, you know, had people who were living with dementia, you know, family and friends or people themselves who had dementia, but people who wanted a literary experience. And so it had to be quite creative.
So there are things in it, like, for example, I love the way you describe the bookcases. You describe it's like having two bookcases, a bookcase for facts and a bookcase for emotions.
Yeah.
And the bookcase for facts is very tall and rickety, and the most recent memories are at the top.
Yes.
And the bookcase for emotions is sort of sturdier and smaller, and the fact is that they're like two tectonic plates, and so they bump into each other.
Yes. The emotional bookcase, the sturdy one, we never lose our emotions because that's a different part of the brain. Detail and facts we lose every day. For example, I won't remember what we've talked about today, tomorrow, but I'll remember how I felt coming here and the emotion of meeting everybody. So the emotional bookcase is so important to remember. As people forget who loved ones are, they still have this recognition that there's an emotional attachment. And that's why I felt it important to say the difference between facts and emotion.
And one thing that you were saying when just before we started was that you don't remember what's in the book.
No. I remember when we were writing it and I'd say to Anna, oh, we really must include this. And Anna would patiently say, we did that last week. So it's very difficult. I know when I read a passage that it's me. But if someone said, oh, what's section 3 on, or even section 1, I haven't a clue.
So how did you go about constructing this, Anna? And you live in Tunbridge Wells. Wendy, where do you live, Wendy?
I live in East Riding of Yorkshire.
You're in Yorkshire?
Yeah.
So it's sort of opposite ends of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Wendy doesn't use the phone anymore. So, yeah. And I remember my friends, my ghostwriting friends, when I said that I wanted to write this book, was saying, do you realise what you're taking on? Because as a ghost, to write a book with someone who doesn't have a memory, because you rely on someone's recollection of events so much. So we just did, I came to see you, didn't I?
Yeah.
And we broke the book down into four parts. The first part was difficult because it was before Wendy's blog started. So that was kind of leading up to her diagnosis. And of course, the flashbacks in the book, you know, the blog didn't exist then.
So there are flashbacks in the book which are written in italics.
Yeah, and the second person.
And written in the second person. So it's like you, the you that I am not anymore.
Mm, yeah. Yes. So it skips between a first person present narrative, and then it has this dual narrative, which is second person past, because obviously Wendy is much more than the woman she is today, somebody who has dementia. She was lots of other wonderful things as well. And so we wanted to be able to capture that and to make Wendy a real fully rounded character, and you had to kind of know what had been lost as well.
And, that's right. And just... it's important to know the differences. And I often say it's how you cope. A lot of your personality from the past helps you to cope with something when it's a sort of life-changing diagnosis. And I think a lot of my character from the past has helped me through that process.
One of the really fascinating little bits was about your relationship with Billy the cat.
Oh, yeah.
Who also appears on your blog. I am now addicted to your blog. But so Billy the cat, you say in one of these italic looking back bits that you were always scared of animals.
I was terrified of animals.
But so the new you is a friend of Billy the cat.
Yeah, absolutely, because I always say that I faced my biggest fear by facing dementia. So anything else is insignificant. What have I got to be afraid of with anything else? So me and Billy are best buddies now.
And you write at one point, how different you are from me, if only I'd been there to act as a conduit. So the idea that the you now could teach the younger you something about...
That's right,
yeah. It's incredibly touching, but also... it's a really profound reflection on what it is to be human, I think, not just about Alzheimer's.
Yeah,
exactly. And what makes us human, you know, what's important to us individually as well. I mean, I remember just before I found Wendy, I had read When Breath Becomes Air. And obviously...
That's the Paul Kalanithi memoir.
Yeah. And as a neurosurgeon, he had to... you know, operate on people's brains and kind of ask individually people, what's more important to you? Do you want to be able to speak? You know, if something's got to go, is it memories that's more important to you or is it speech? And so, and his, you know, whole book was about, you know, what makes you human? What is the thing? And it's a very individual thing. And so that's why I was hoping that this book would be kind of the dementia version of that, in that it's questioning, what are we if we lose all our memories, if we lose everything that's made us uniquely us? And it is the most terrifying thing, because you could lose an arm or a leg, and you know, you can carry on and you can, and you're still you, but if you lose your memories and all your history and your past, then you know.
But I'm always saying that, you know, people shouldn't concentrate on what we lose. You should concentrate on, you know, what you have now and the new things that come your way, and then using your talents in a different way. There's no reason why, you know, people have often said to me, you know, but how can you have written a book? You've got dementia. Well, I just say, well, why not? You know, I had talents before I had dementia. You don't suddenly lose those overnight when you get a diagnosis. You just use things in different ways.
But you're obviously a very resourceful woman, aren't you? And so, for example, you talk about rediscovering short stories.
Yes.
Rather than reading novels, and rediscovering your love of poetry.
Yes.
Because they're short.
That's right. There's always a way round. So, you know, dementia can take away so many things from you, but it's also a way of trying to outwit it and find a different way to still enjoy the things that you enjoy.
You obviously have a very strong relationship now. You're joking away on your way up.
Yeah, we spend most days WhatsApping.
Yeah.
And we have lots of jokes.
We do.
I scream grab most of them because they're so funny.
Yeah.
Things when Wendy said, well, there was something the other day and she said, oh, forget it. And I said, that's easy for you to say, Wendy. And we just send each other lots of laughing emojis and things. And it was funny as well, because I don't have the best memory myself. So we kind of evened out during the writing process. There was one day where I had an osteopath appointment and I sat down at 5 to 11 with a coffee to start writing for the day. And I emailed Wendy and asked her some question. And then she said, shouldn't you be at your osteopath appointment? I was like, oh, no, yes. I had to like dash out and run up the road because she'd remembered.
Everything suddenly went quiet and I knew she'd gone.
Yeah, so yeah, we did. We were a good match, really.
We were a good team.
Yeah, we were a very good team.
Yeah.
There is a sort of strand of anger in it, which is partly about the National Health Service and how actually unprepared it is to deal with this. And you were, and particularly since you worked in the National Health Service for 20 years, and then you were sort of cast out by it.
Well, anger is the wrong word for me now, because many people lose emotions and I've lost the ability to be angry. But what I haven't lost the ability to do is to be sad. So the anger is always taken over by sadness now. And yes, the lack of understanding and what was needed at that time, three and a half years ago, was very lacking in knowing what to do with an employee who had dementia. The NHS is, you know, very good at focusing things on patients, but maybe not so good at focusing on employees around them.
And you're an administrator, so it wasn't that you were going to make a mistake in an operation or something. You
no.
were doing, but you were doing staff rotas and
That's
things like
right.
that.
Yes. And if you think about it, I had so much knowledge at that point in time that other people in the team didn't have. It was really naive to think that the best thing to do was for me to retire. But as you said, I'm quite resilient, so I came up with my own plan for a way that I could carry on working for as long as I chose to. And because there was so little understanding, they agreed to my plan. But really, it should have been a two-way conversation. And hopefully things now are possibly better for people that are coming behind me.
Do you think things are getting better?
Well, at the time when I was still at work, I worked with NHS employers to write a toolkit for anyone affected by dementia. So whether they were people with dementia or people supporting someone with dementia in the workplace, and the best way to help them. So hopefully the toolkit is being used, but who knows.
The other side of it is there's an awful lot of love in it, and particularly for your two daughters,
yes.
Gemma and Sarah.
Yeah.
Gemma is owner of Billy the Cat.
That's right,
it?
Yeah. I don't often admit that, but yes. Billy lives with Gemma.
And I know when there was a lovely profile of you in The Observer, and it was mentioning your habit of not eating very much.
Yeah.
And then on your blog you were saying, no, I actually just don't start sending me sandwiches because
yes, because people started getting worried about me. So I was saying, don't send me food parcels, because Stuart, Gemma's partner, he does cook for me a couple of times a week, and I've lost that ability to feel hunger, and food doesn't interest me anymore. So they force me to eat twice a week properly.
You know also that you mentioned Billy, and you know Billy the cat uses Wendy's dementia against her to get extra food.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read that passage in the book where he kind of, like most cats, pretends he hasn't been fed and stares kind of forlornly at his food bowl. And Wendy thinks she hasn't fed him and feeds him again. And then a few minutes later, he's staring again. And Gemma had put him on a diet and couldn't understand why he was still putting on weight, even though Wendy was looking after him. She was saying,
I won't be trusted to look after him for long.
So will you continue with the blog?
Oh, yeah, the blog is there as my memory. That was the whole purpose of the blog, to simply remind me of all the wonderful things I've done. Otherwise they'd simply be lost.
And might you do another project together?
Oh, don't know. I haven't thought about it.
I know. I've got to let Anna recover from this one first.
I think as well that you write a lot more on your blogs now, because when you started it was just more of a... like a diary entry of what you did that day.
Yeah.
But I've noticed that your blogs are getting longer now, maybe.
Well, you taught me how to write better in the detail.
That. Well, yes, the detail that
yes,
I like.
All that sort of thing.
Yes, so. And that's what this book also has, that ability to pick out a little detail that speaks for so much.
That's right, yes. Anna taught me that very early on.
Well, I think you realise that it's the detail that I love, because that's what brings the colour and the story out of the page for readers. What was interesting is that sometimes I would ask Wendy about something, you know, okay, today we need to talk about this. And I would get one version of events. But then the next day, if I went back to it, I'd get perhaps a slightly different version, which you could think was a bad thing, but actually it helped kind of layer and colour the picture even more. And then someday she would send me a WhatsApp picture of a post-it note that she'd scribbled, her kind of subconscious had scribbled in the night, and she'd send it to me and say, does this mean anything to you? And I said, oh yeah, we were talking about that yesterday, and some other thought had come. So actually it was almost like she was recovering memories which she thought had long since been lost during the process, which was really nice. And her recollection of her former life, if you like, the second person narrative, well, I think it was better than mine.
And that's because it's halfway down the bookshelf.
That's right. Yeah. And yeah. I used to have a brilliant memory.
Mm. Yeah. You've sort of put a bit of that into the book, haven't you? So, for example, you talk about meeting the woman in the meeting who was going to, said she had booked her place at Dignitas.
Yeah.
And then later on, you come back to it. But you come and you just, I just sort of think that the echo of that, you have this sense in the book of arriving back at something that maybe you'd forgotten that had happened early on in the book, but it still resonates.
That subject also was a difficult one for Wendy, and we had lots of discussions off the page about that, because it was something that you were still
working my way through.
Yeah, and things that you hadn't really discussed with Sarah and Gemma.
Oh,
so
yeah.
to talk to me about them, you know, Wendy wasn't quite ready, but I felt that it was something we needed to tackle in the book, and there were some difficult things and questions.
You used to say, send me a WhatsApp in the morning saying, you realise I'm going to probe today.
Yeah.
Just to warn me what was coming.
I'd get the little shocked face emoji back.
Yeah.
But we needed to probe, and, you know, because we needed to delve deeper and deeper. And I think you're pleased that you
It always worked. It was just you had to find a way of getting it out of me, didn't you?
Yeah, because also Wendy was a really, really private person before dementia. The dementia has kind of made you much more open. And Sarah and Gemma told me as well, you know, how private she was. I mean, this is not the type of thing that the Wendy pre-dementia would have done.
Absolutely not. No, but none of it whatsoever. I mean, the girls laugh now at the extent in which I'm public now.
And you look public in your lovely red shirt and your zingy red glasses. I really like them.
Well, that's the other thing. Colour has taken on a whole new meaning, because now I hate black, whereas I used to always wear black. Yeah, I think I've been overtaken by aliens, really.
Wendy Mitchell and Anna Wharton there, talking to Claire Armitstead. Somebody I Used to Know is published by Bloomsbury and is out now. You can find Wendy's blog at whichmeamitoday.wordpress.com, and Dr. Jules Montague's Lost and Found is published by Sceptre and is out on the 8th of March. Next week, cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker presents his manifesto, using facts and interpreted data from the Enlightenment onwards to prove to us, whatever we might see to contradict, life is getting better, and progress is moving us forward after all. Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development, and more. You can find them at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.